From ancient Rome to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, with the only man on the planet who can speak with real erudition about all three. With us today on Uncommon Knowledge, Victor Davis Hanson. Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Victor Davis Hanson grew up on a ranch in the San Joaquin Valley town of Selma, the fifth generation of his family to live in the same house. Dr. Hanson received his undergraduate degree from UC Santa Cruz and a doctorate in classics from Stanford. For many years, Dr. Hanson worked the family ranch while teaching at Fresno State. Since 2002, he has served as a fellow at the Hoover Institution. Dr. Hanson is the author of more than a dozen books on the ancient world and military history, including his classic work, A War Like No Other, How the Athenians and Spartans Fought the Peloponnesian War, and most recently, The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost from Ancient Greece to Iraq. I should add that Dr. Hanson's next book, The Second World Wars, will be published in September of 2017. Dr. Hanson also, as if he weren't busy enough, writes a regular column that appears in newspapers and on websites across the country. Victor Davis Hanson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Victor, I'm going to quote you to yourself. This is a review of a book called Colossus by our colleague here at Hoover, Neil Ferguson, that you wrote a few years ago. Victor Davis Hanson, quote, "Those who got it right about America were not Woodrow Wilson and Jimmy Carter, but Teddy Roosevelt and Douglas MacArthur. We should be natural imperialists, given our wealth and expertise."
Yes.
Okay, so the United States as an imperial power, and it ought to just embrace that role.
If you looked at the entire quote, which I'm not suggesting that you didn't.
Well, I did, of course, but it's so much more fun just to quote a bit of it.
The optative mood should means that by all regional calculations, a country without that potential size, military clout, should be imperial. And what I was trying to say is that where we exercise enormous hegemonies, they're a different sort than traditional imperial. We haven't taken anybody's land since 1998. World War II, we lost 440,000 people, and we gave back Okinawa, and we gave back most of the land in Europe that we occupied. So we're a funny sort of empire. That was my point, that by every calculus, we should be imperial. That's what people do. They try to aggrandize their land, their territory, their natural resources. The United States created that post-war order and then played by its own set of rules, and by 1970 was losing out to Japan and Germany and now, in some sense, China. So we're a funny sort of empire.
Let me quote you again. "Americans are endowed with an exceptional moral sense. We are a generous people whose checkered imperial interventions in the past rarely proved profitable or exploitive." So let's talk about the one explicit colony we had, the Philippines.
Yes. Well, we inherited the Philippines after we defeated the Spanish in the Spanish Civil War, and then we promised to give them independence in the mid-1946, and then we fought an insurrection against the Islamic Moros. And then World War II came along, and we decided, even though it was not, if you look at the map, it's not on the trajectory to Japan. We lost the Philippines. We lost over 12,000 soldiers dead trying to defend it. Then we gave it back to the Philippines. But when Douglas MacArthur said, "I shall return," Chester Nimitz and others said, "That's not on the way to Japan." And so we lost another 50,000 casualties trying to retake the Philippines from the Japanese. We would have probably been better off just to keep going island hopping straight on the way and bypassed it. But the Philippines, for all of the acrimony, it's never been a possession that the United States tried to exploit, take its resources, annex, divide, trisect. None. We've been clumsy, we've been insensitive, but I guess my experience with the Philippines is that famous sign when we left, finally at Subic Bay, it said, "Go home, Yankees, and take me with you."
Right, right.
And a lot of Philippines wanted to come to the United States.
So the Philippines are the engagement, that's the closest we come to a kind of traditional colony, and yet it cost us. That's the point.
It cost us a lot of money. And we didn't
lives.
Yes, and we didn't go out trying to get it. We were stuck with it after Spain was defeated and abdicated, and then we didn't know what to do with it. And then we had an enormous anti-war movement about even going in and trying to defeat the insurrectionist, and then we had sort of a proconsul there. And it wasn't a happy time in American life. People were not excited that they had the Philippines.
Right, right.
There were constant debates. That's my point. And we don't do that very well. And we don't take people's land. We have an imperial order, but it's a post-war order in which we set rules. And in terms of commerce or trade, we allow Japan or Germany or China, with much less military power than us, to beat us economically, and they do.
Okay, so let's talk about, we're uncomfortable. To the extent that we've ever been an imperial power, we've been a pretty generous one, a pretty altruistic one. There's no evidence that anybody who takes a fair look at American history could adduce that we have used our power to exploit in economic or other terms anything that might even be termed loosely an American possession. We grant that. Now, this post-war order, this America as top nation for some seven decades now, the Cold War is over, and yet the United States retains something like 150 military bases.
Yes.
We continue to spend so much on our military that we spend more than the next seven defense budgets combined. I believe that's the current statistic. We outspend, and that comes out of the pockets of American taxpayers.
Yes.
So the question then is Victor Davis Hanson pleased that the United States still retains this dominance around the world, or would he be in the camp that says, with Barack Obama, hold on, we can't continue this without, in one fundamental way or another, humiliating other people. We should withdraw. We should seek to encourage other nations to take responsibility for their own regions. This has gone on long enough, and we should withdraw.
Well, I'm not in agreement that we should withdraw, but I am in agreement that we have an aggregate of $20 trillion in debt, and so we have to be very selective in how we apply U.S. power to create deterrence, and that's all it's valuable for, to create a deterrent effect so that history's great monsters, and they're always there, don't try to do something stupid. Most wars are started by weaker powers who have convinced themselves that the stronger are either too complacent or they don't want to take the trouble to police the area, and they're going to try something stupid. By that I mean, we don't want China to keep expanding this archipelago in the South China Sea.
China in the Pacific, Victor Davis Hanson. Quote, China believes, now I'm quoting a recent column, China believes it is finally time to make its military reflect its enormous economic power. So, one argument is the United States has kept the peace across the Pacific. Yeah. The United States Navy has kept the peace across the Pacific. It has permitted the post-war growth of the economy of Japan, which is now a rich nation and which has had to spend almost nothing on its own defense. It is permitted, the Australians don't like to hear this, but it is permitted the freedom of Australia, which is essentially an Anglo-Saxon nation surrounded by Asian powers. And we ought to do whatever it takes to keep that up. Argument one. Argument two, oh, for goodness sake, look at Chinese history. They insist when they're powerful on being the great hegemon in their own region, but only in their own region. They're not coming after us.
That's
Let them
point.
Have the South Pacific if they want it.
The point is that there's a number of countries throughout the world that could build nuclear weapons as they do Mercedes or Hondas, and they choose not to. And they choose not to because they feel that the United States is a guarantor of their safety and security, Japan. So if we decide that it's too risky to put a carrier in the South China Sea occasionally, or we don't want to pledge Los Angeles to the security of Seoul, then there's going to be a void. And the Chinese are going to absorb that and become a regional hegemony, just like Iran is trying to do in the Persian Gulf, just as Russia is trying to do with the former Soviet republics, just like ISIS is trying to do in the Middle East. And the question then is, how will that be deterred? And there's always deterrence. It's just a matter of who's going to do it and at what cost. So you'll probably see, if we were to withdraw entirely, that Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, perhaps even Australia and the Philippines, they all have a capability of becoming nuclear. And that would deter China. If we want five nuclear additional powers, and we could say, well, they're at least democratic, although in the case of the Philippines lately, it would be quite scary. So we can do that. So what I'm suggesting is we just don't scare people. We have a reasoned discussion and say, if you don't want to be engaged overseas, these are the likely scenarios that would happen in the vacuum. Do you prefer that, or do you prefer maintaining some kind of deterrence? Does it mean that we have to do it alone? No. We can get smarter with regional allies. We can make them pay more. We can recalibrate NATO. But the 75 years after World War II is an aberration in world history. It's peace is a parenthesis. I'm quoting Plato, of all people. And war, unfortunately, is a natural order of things. And in a vacuum, we're going to see that very quickly.
Iran. Under President Obama's agreement with Iran, this past winter, foreign nations ended their sanctions on Iran's nuclear program. Iran, in return, dismantled a plutonium reactor and shipped enriched materials to Russia, and also reduced its stock of centrifuges. I quote the Secretary of State, John Kerry, quote, "Iran was hurtling towards an unaccounted for, uninspected, full-fledged nuclear program. Now, at Iran's consent and agreement, they have rolled back from that," close quote. There you have, Victor, a diplomatic triumph, correct?
No, what's happened is when John Kerry said that, he didn't include that to get that agreement, we had to overlook things like spot inspections and the shipping of all uranium out of country to be examined by third parties, adjudicators. But more importantly, this was sold as a mechanism to changing Iranian behavior. And there were a lot of side agreements, one with the UN about ballistic missiles. So once that agreement was signed, did we see a thawing of relations? No, we saw just the opposite, that a U.S. carrier had an Iranian missile shot at it. We had American sailors hijacked on the high sea and taken hostages. We have Iranian PT boats that normally disrupt the trajectories of American warships. We had this very strange deal where in the middle of the night we sent $400 million in cash on pallets. And then when the President of the United States said we had to do it because we couldn't wire money and without violating the sanctions, of course, we did that as well. So their behavior afterwards is one of a power like Hitler after Munich, who said, you know what, I have nothing but contempt for anybody who would believe my own lies. And we forget sometimes that what causes war is when a stronger power is humiliated by a weaker power, and the weaker power then says, I have a special contempt for them because they have the military power to deter me, but they choose because of moral cowardice, weakness, uncertainty, not to use it. So you think that after Munich, Neville Chamberlain would be very popular in the Reichstag.
Right.
And what did Hitler say to him? If I ever see that guy again, I'm going to jump on him and jump on his chest and break that umbrella over his head. What he meant was, the British have a bigger navy than I do. They have their air force is comparable, and yet he's scared of me. Why? Because he's a. And I'm not arguing that we need to be, gratuitously mean. I'm just saying that when the Iranians look at us and see that our responsibilities, and we don't protect our allies, or we don't sound suspicious, but we're naive and gullible enough for peace at any price to concede to them, then they have contempt for us. And they've just changed their calibrating their trajectory. Maybe 10 years, maybe 3 years, maybe 5 years, but we're living, in terms of nuclear weapons, you count centuries. And if they get a bomb in 10 years, rather than in 3 years, I don't think it's much of an advantage for us.
Russia, Victor Davis Hanson, quote, "From the czars to the Soviet communists to Vladimir Putin's cronies, there is something about constitutional government and liberal rule that bothers Mother Russia," close quote. Explain that.
Well, I'm just trying to find out if anybody can tell me where there was a constitutional system intact. Maybe you could argue the czars were trying to move in that direction at the beginning of the 20th century. Some naive people thought that Leninism might be a benign form of communism. After the fall of the Soviet Union, people said that Yeltsin was going to have a parliamentary system that would be viable. But if anybody can find one example of a sustained constitutional system, then that would refute my fear, but I can't.
Can't you? So, deeper question, I think. Why should it be that history that political cultures should be so enduring. Why should it be? We can talk ourselves until we're blue in the face about Russian sense of hostility because of the Mongol invasions. We can talk about the vastness of the steppe and how they have over the centuries had to think constantly in terms of their own defense, suspicion of foreigners. But for goodness sake, it's the 21st century. They had a chance at democracy under Yeltsin, and it didn't work somehow. Yes. How is it that history is so hard to overcome? The Middle East, it's just, why can't these people just...
I think if I could be reductionist, there's a simple platitude that might explain that angst on your part, and that is that the absence of constitutional government is pretty much the norm outside the West. And by the West, I mean the culture that originated in Greece and Rome, and over the periods of the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, morphed into Northern Europe, and then through the British experience, transcended Europe and popped up in places like Australia, Canada, the Dominions, and then after World War II was implanted by force by the United States in Japan. And it's an aberration, both historically and contemporaneously. So the idea that people will get together and follow constitutional law by the consent of the governed, it's not the norm, and most places reject it. It has a lot of liabilities, but it's better than the alternative. But if you don't have any experience with it, the only way that it can be implanted is through force. And we did it sometimes successfully with Italy and Germany and Japan and Korea. But if in the postmodern era, and it was working in Iraq for a while, we defeated the enemy, we humiliated al-Qaeda, we rid them, we planted Americans, we put a gun to the head of the Iraqis, said, you're going to treat everybody in minorities according to proportional representation. Then we pulled out, as if we had pulled out of South Korea, say, 1958, and said, well, we don't want to stay in South Korea any longer. You can imagine what South Korea would look like today. It wouldn't exist.
Right. What does Vladimir Putin want next?
Well, Vladimir Putin wants whatever people are going to give him. So he does a basic calculation. Is it if going into eastern Ukraine or going into the Baltic states are 51% more likely to benefit him, then he might take the alternative. He wants to reconstitute the former Soviet republics under an autocratic system. And his way of thinking, the Baltic states are Russian, Ukraine is Russian, Eastern Europe is a necessary buffer, and I'm going to reconstitute that, preferably without war, in occasion, once in a while with war, or to the degree that the West and the United States is going to let me do it.
So, again, the China argument, all they're interested in is hegemony within their own region. Russia, nobody thinks Vladimir Putin wants to go all the way to Berlin. He's got the Baltic states, maybe he wants half of Ukraine, maybe he wants all of Ukraine. Suppose he did reconstitute the old Soviet Union. Suppose he brought under his pretty direct control every country that was a Soviet republic. Why should we care?
Well, I think the conflict of visions is one in the following way. If we want to withdraw and say, that's not our business, after Libya and after Syria and after Afghanistan, Iraq, just let them be. They're never going to do what we want anyway. Just save blood and treasure. That's one point. Mm-hmm. But the other is that you're going to establish local, to use a fancy word, hegemonies. And you're going to have the Chinese dictating to how people conduct their foreign policy, their internal affairs in places like Taiwan, South Korea, the Philippines, Japan. And that's okay if you want to do that. There might not. We can do it without a war. We can say the same thing with the Soviets. That's their natural sphere of influence. You guys in the Baltic states, you guys in the, just forget these little pipe dreams of democracy, personal freedom, writing what you want. You're now part of the Russian orbit. We can go into the Middle East and say the people of Syria, the people in the Iraq area, the people along the Gulf monarchies, because they're going to be very vulnerable. You may not like the Shia theocracy, but you didn't have democracy. Just go, that's their area.
Right.
And we can do the same thing with this new authoritarian movement in Venezuela and Bolivia and Peru. Just let them do it.
Right.
And then the question is, if we let this, and we did this before, we've done it on a number of occasions. The questions are twofold. Is it fair to tell the people of Japan or the people of Bahrain or the people of Estonia, sorry, we're just not going to help you. You're just son of your history's losers. That's number one. And as you multiply these blocks, these antithetical blocks, at some point do they create a mass? And by that I mean, just let Mussolini do his thing in the Mediterranean in the 1930s. It's none of our business if he goes into Somalia. Who cares?
Right, who cares?
Who cares if they go in and they remilitarize the Rhineland? And who cares if the Soviets go into Finland or they divide Poland up with Russia? And who cares about New Guinea or the Dutch East Indies or French Indochina if Japan absorbs it? And that's what we did. And then all of a sudden we looked around and we thought, wow, all of these blocks are getting very big and they're getting very powerful and they all have one thing in common. They hate us.
Right.
And they're working on ways to emasculate us. And we see it at Pearl Harbor on December 11th, Hitler declares war. And then all of a sudden we go the other way and say, we're going to go and get involved. We're not going to do like we did after World War I. So it's a yin and yang, and there's arguments for both. But I think over the long haul, reasoned engagement and the establishment of deterrence saves lives and is in our interest.
Got it. Home.
Yes.
From abroad to home. Victor Davis Hanson, quote, Rome worked when foreigners crossed through its borders to become Romans. It failed when newcomers fled into the empire and adhered to their own cultures.
Yes. Yes.
Close quote. Explain that.
Well, historically, there's three elements to immigration that adjudicate whether it's failed or successful. One, is it diverse? When people come into Rome, do they come into Rome from all over the Mediterranean or the Eastern world, or do they just come from across the Danube and the Rhine, right, as they did in the 5th century? Number two, is it measured? Do people come in numbers that so one immigrant meets 10 natives, or one person from Gaul, or one person from Poland then meets 10 Italians, and they learn how to assimilate and, right, intermarry and, right, integrate? Or do they come en masse and create enclaves? And then number three, do they come under some legal auspices and learn the language, and it's measured and it's some degree meritocratic? And if those conditions have been met, as they have been mostly in American history, then it works wonderfully. It enriches the body politic. People are invigorated by these new people who want to be American more than they do. However, if you allow it not to be diverse, but largely from one area,
Mexico
or Latin America, then the people are coming are not going to assimilate quick enough, because they're going to be an in block. And if they do it illegally and they don't know English, they have further obstacles to overcome. And if it's not meritocratic, then we have to tell the brain surgeon from Kenya, or we have to tell the accountant from South Korea, or we have to tell the nuclear physicist from Argentina, sorry, you just didn't happen to live close enough to the Rio Grande, so you can't come. You may be legal, you may have a skill set that we need, but this is not how we're going to adjudicate it. And it doesn't seem that that's going to be either fair or legal. So we need to get immigration diverse from as many different places as possible.
So that you don't get overwhelmed by a single culture.
By one particular group. And more importantly, that one particular group is not used by domestic political parties for their own electoral calculations, as it happened in the 19th century. And then it has to be legal. It has to be in numbers that can be assimilated. And it has to be meritocratic. It has to have a system why we say you can come and you can't. And we don't have that now.
Victor, the Wall Street Journal this past summer, quote, increasing net annual immigration by 50% a year would increase GDP growth on average from 1.7% to 2% a year over the next 35 years. It would also mean more workers per retiree, reducing the stress on Medicare and Social Security, close quote.
According to
let them in. It'll boost economic growth.
According to the Wall Street Journal, if that calculus was correct, why not let in 50 million? Because the GDP would grow even bigger. And the answer is that the Wall Street Journal thinks in terms of profit and loss, but not in culture and social life and stability. I came up here yesterday.
In other words, you're willing to grant that within some range, more immigrants might produce economic growth, but the other kinds of costs are too high.
I don't think they're calibrating certain costs. And by that, I mean, I came up here yesterday. Somebody who
was from Southern California.
Somebody who was here illegally was in a semi and flipped it and blocked the entire six lanes of the 99 freeway. Last week, some gangbangers, for the first time in the history of my local school, shot an automatic weapon and closed down a football game. First time it ever happened. So there are social problems when you bring so many people, and the host, us, no longer believes in the melting pot, but has rebranded it the salad bowl, and we feel it's hurtful, unfair, not right, not to assimilate, integrate, and intermarry people. And the tragedy of all this is that people who came in the past, i.e. before 30 years ago, and they're in my own family who are Mexican-American. I have a sister-in-law who's Mexican-American. I have nieces and nephews. It worked perfectly. They had the same experience as the Italian-Americans of the 19th century. Today, if I say to you, is Rudy Giuliani or the Cuomos, what political party? Cuomo, Giuliani. You wouldn't know. You would say, well, one's Democrat and one's Republican, because it's incidental, not essential to their character.
Right.
Because they've been assimilated. We don't have an Italian-American studies department in the way that we have La Raza. Nobody in the Italian-American community says, I'm a member of La Raza with two Z's, the way Mussolini said. They say they don't do it because they have no need to, because they've been assimilated. And, you know, everybody has this problem. My father only bought used Volvos. We had to eat Swedish crackers. We had to buy Electrolux's vacuum cleaner.
Because you were good Swedes.
Because we were good Swedes.
But and your father served in the Second World War.
I said to my dad when I'm in high school, Dad, they're all played out. Kingsburg is no longer a Swedish community. They're all intermarried. It doesn't exist anymore. And he said, yeah, you're right. And I didn't learn Swedish. So the point I'm making is that if we were to go back to that system, then all of this political, ethnic, chauvinistic identity politics would die on the vine. But too many people are invested in it. And it's been very lucrative for a number of people's careers.
The legacy of Barack Obama. Victor Davis Hanson, quote, President Obama has systematically adopted a rhetoric and an agenda that is predicated on dividing up the country according to tribal grievances in hopes of recalibrating various factions into a majority grievance culture. A majority grievance culture. He has succeeded politically, but in doing so, he has nearly torn the country apart. Barack Obama, first of all, what do you mean by a majority grievance culture?
Well, it means that 51% of the population feels that they have a grievance against the population. And so when you say that gays and women and Latinos and Asians and blacks and people of mixed ancestry and the disabled, each person can say that my particular identity is essential, not incidental to my character. And we're talking right now when we have riots going on in Charlotte, North Carolina, in a parent's situation where an African-American policeman shot an African-American suspect who may probably have been armed with an African-American police chief, and that set off a riot. And that suggests that people, if they're going to riot in a situation, they, meaning the protesters, what if the police chief had been white? What if the officer involved had been Asian? It wouldn't have made, it would have been worse, less worse? I don't know. But we reached a situation in which we're going to have to come to terms with a lot of situations. The president, when he came into office, he did things that I hadn't seen in my lifetime. I've never heard a presidential candidate say typical white person, at least not since reading about it in the 1920s or 30s. Woodrow Wilson was the last person to identify that strongly with race. I didn't hear Bill Clinton say in the OJ trial, well, Nicole Simpson looks like the second daughter I might have had, right in the middle of a trial, and the way that Obama editorialized about Trayvon Martin. And then you get into the beer summit, and all of that language created this image that it was okay to identify by your tribal affiliation. And that had been something in America. We're the only multiracial society. If anybody can find an example in the Balkans or Rwanda or Iraq where it works, tell me about it. But it's never worked, doesn't work very well in India. But we're the only ones that work. And it was because for all the problems of slavery and Jim Crow and discrimination, the original European colonists who came to this continent evolved according to the ideas in the Declaration and the Constitution that race would eventually be insignificant. And it's hard for a majority population to do that, but we are evolving in the right direction. Apparently, under Obama, we felt that that's impossible, so that we are prisoners of our past, and it's important that we all identify according to tribal affiliations. And that's where we're going right now. And I don't think there's any history that I know of where that's going to work out well.
The way ahead, Hillary and Donald Trump. Victor Davis Hanson, quote, broke when they left the White House in 2001, Bill and Hillary Clinton leveraged Hillary Clinton's political career to amass a personal fortune of between 100 and 200 million, all in the form of quid pro quo investments by wealthy individuals and foreign governments. No other first family has so unapologetically charged banks, foreign governments, corporations, and universities so much money. Yes, yes, yes. But isn't every thinking person still in favor of Hillary Clinton?
Well, they've created a culture in which the thinking, reason, and rational person alone is Hillary Clinton, and the buffoon or the fanatic or the lunatic or the unhinged is for Donald Trump. But regarding that quote, the Clintons offered something that no other president, ex-president, had ever offered. Jimmy Carter raised money for his foundation, but he was a very simple guy. He didn't try to shake down corporations for speaking fees. Reagan tried it for a little bit and quit. Jerry Ford wanted to go golf in Southern California. George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush did not do it to much extent. But Clinton had something that they didn't have. He had a wife, a spouse, who he told people, we'll be back in here.
Right.
And she's a viable presidential candidate in a way that Barbara Bush or Mrs. Carter, none of them were. And I'm going to be back here with her as president, de facto president. And therefore, you better invest in her as Secretary of State through this foundation, and we're going to remember it. And so that's the font of all of their ethical problems. They had a premise that was predicated on selling influence for money.
Victor Davis Hanson on Donald Trump, quote, the media, the punditocracy, the universities, the political establishment, Wall Street, the big banks, the mega wealthy, even the Koch brothers and Hank Paulson, former head of Goldman Sachs, can't stand Trump. He should be down by 20 points, but he's not. Why isn't he?
Well, he represents an anger at the much overused word elites. Elites are people who, not just by money, but basically have a utopian vision that they feel that does not apply to themselves, and they have the money, culture, and influence to navigate around the ramifications of their own ideology. So what do I mean by that? Mark Zuckerberg lectures all of us about how a wall is bad, and then he builds a wall or tries to build a Maginot line around his own home. Or we're told just how terrible charter schools are, and you can't do that, and Barack Obama purchased kids and Sidwell Friends. Or Al Gore says, you know what, the planet is heating up, carbon is the problem, but I'm going to sell my cable channel to Qatar and their fossil fuel fortunes, and I'm going to try to beat the capital gains tax in a way that John Kerry moved his yacht to Rhode Island to avoid the high taxes he wants on everybody else. And it became so an aggregate, so large, that people got sick of them. And so Donald Trump is Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare. She's Barack Obama's nemesis, and he's a vampire's mirror for the Republican establishment. They look in him, and they see them. They don't even see them as if they're nothing, and that's because the Republicans of all people allowed the borders to stay open. They could have stopped the $20 trillion in the national debt. They did a noble job trying to stop Obamacare, but failed. And when a Republican legislator retires in Washington, there's no difference between his Democratic counterpart and his eagerness to get rich by virtue of his past office.
Victor, we're taping this 6 weeks before Election Day. Care to call it? Would you care to call it?
Well, I could say that I'll say two things. It won't be a blowout, and I think it will be 1 or 2 points, either one. Every rational person, I don't look at polls, I look what bookies say. Because they really have skin in the game, and they still believe that Hillary's money, her ground game, her organization, her endorsements, and the establishment cannot be beat. They also said that about Barack Obama. So I'm saying it's a 50-50. I will say that
They also said about the British exit from the European Union.
Yes, they did do that. I will say two things. One is when I meet people here at Hoover or National Review, where I write, or any other venue, the people who are willing to vote for Trump, usually he was not their first candidate, and they're very shy about it. They don't want to admit it. They're sort of like the invasion of the body snatchers. You really don't know they've been snatched yet. They're just quiet, or they're in the closet. The people who are virulently anti-Trump, it's almost as if they're a virtue monger. They just want to tell everybody how virtuous they are. Not in my name would I ever vote. So I have a feeling that
there's a hidden vote.
Yeah, I have a feeling there's somewhat of a hidden vote. The other thing is that a lot of the editorialization and the media anger at Trump is predicated on blowing him out. If he is blown out by 6 to 8 points, then the Republican establishment who opposed him says, I warned you, he is a disastrous for the Republican Party. He did to you what Goldwater did, and I'm the pundit, right, the predicate. However, if he were to lose by 1 or 2 points, then people are going to say, you were the missing tessera in the mosaic that could have got him elected. And if Hillary wins, of course, they're out too. So there's a lot of people who are predicated in a Trump blowout. And so, again, ad nauseum, he's terrible, he's Hitler, he's Stalin. One of the weirdest things is the so-called Republican establishment, Democratic establishment, the Washington, D.C., sophisticated, nuanced people. And when you read what they write in very sophisticated historical nuances, they say, he's Mussolini, he's Hitler, he's Stalin, he's a brown shirt, he's a black shirt. Get a life, you know what I mean?
Victor, last question. Here we sit, one candidate for president, Hillary Clinton, is corrupt. She's told untruths about her emails. She and her husband have shaken down big banks, just as you explained, and is known to be corrupt. The other candidate, Donald Trump, I think the best construction we can put on it is to say he is just amazingly vulgar and undisciplined. And so here's the question. Is there anything about this that reminds you of Rome and about the late 4th century? Do you look at this country and say, from Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, do you get the whiff of decay? Is there something that's irreversible here?
In the year 69 AD, Nero of all people was killed. And did they find a Cicero, or did they find an elder Cato or Scipio from the Republic? No, they had a choice between Otho and Galba and Vitellus. And that's where we are. But it's almost as if saying, there's a radioactive field here that's been contaminated by a bomb, don't go in it. Or there's an area over here that I think is radioactive, you shouldn't go in it. That's the choice. So the way I look at it is, we know what Hillary has done. We know what Trump is capable of. So would you prefer to go where something is radioactive, or where something might be radioactive? That's what we've been reduced to.
And so are you... Do you, 10 years from now, could the United States really, Nero's gone, and Rome succeeds. I mean, you've got 200 years of pretty good peaceful times and some prosperity. I mean, is this recoverable, or are we in the end days?
Well, we always say it's not recoverable, but it is. Milton Friedman said there's a lot of rot in capitalist democracies that you can expend. So... yeah, I think that the issue is not Trump or Hillary. It's $20 trillion in debt, cultural and social and racial division, a healthcare system that doesn't work, a failed foreign policy, and an entitlement industry that's not sustainable. And those problems have self-correcting mechanisms called chaos. And we're either going to have chaos or somebody's going to preempt them and do it. And I will say that people are very... naive about their past. If I were to ask a progressive, who was the best president of the 20th century? They would tell me Woodrow Wilson, maybe FDR. And I'm thinking, who was the most racist president that was elected in the 20th century? Woodrow Wilson. He stopped all integration. He wouldn't integrate we could have had the armed forces integrated 30 years earlier. His Versailles Treaty, what he did at Versailles, guaranteed a war in 2020. 20 years. His idea of trying to undermine and destroy the Constitution through progressive, it was a disaster. And yet, we not only recovered from him, but now people look back very nostalgically and say he was a hero. So there's a clear choice. There's no such thing as they're both the same. Neutrality, whether people want to admit it or not, being neutral is not being neutral. It's like a vegetarian tiger. It doesn't exist. You either 51% or 49. This is a Manichaean election, and you don't say Trump is boring, she's got orange hair, he's got that fake tan, and Hillary has got health problems. You say she has a group of advisors, and she has a tradition, and she has a political party. She's an imperfect vessel. He has people around him that represent a more conservative approach. He's an imperfect vessel, but I'm going to vote for which is more conservative or which is more progressive. And there's a clear choice.
Victor Davis Hanson, thank you.
Thank you.
For Uncommon Knowledge in the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.